Welcome, welcome, welcome. This is the Distraction Pieces podcast, episode 425. And it's a bonus episode on Friday. Strong language warning off the bat. That's needed immediately. It's a really good conversation, and it's a, you know, you might find it a surprisingly grown-up conversation. It's worth mentioning that we recorded this about 3 weeks ago. So when we talk about Boris and that lot, the anger expressed is pre all of the most recent stuff of the last week or two. But yeah, this week's guest is comedian and musician Cunt and the Gang. And you may be familiar with Cunt's other band, The Cunts. I said strong language warning. There's going to be a lot of this. Because they got to number 5 in the charts last year at Christmas with Boris Johnson is a fucking cunt. I couldn't be clearer on the strong language warning. And they're back this year with Boris Johnson still a fucking cunt. For obvious reasons. And I think this last week or two couldn't have been a better promotional campaign for the song and for the band, largely due to the actions of Boris and his pals. Yeah, I wonder if last year's song was on their Downing Street party playlist. Who knows? Who knows? Obviously, with Christmas coming, you can support the podcast and me and all these things. If you've enjoyed the podcast over the year, basically, head to speechdevelopmentrecords.com and buy some lovely merch. We've still got some copies of the Distraction Pieces book, which was a Times bestseller. So it's worth going and having a look there. We've got the 10-year anniversary Distraction Pieces vinyl of the album Distraction Pieces, a great gift for anyone who's a fan of me and my music. And there's just loads of winter wares. There's hats, there's scarves, there's the best gloves ever made. All sorts of good stuff. So head over to speechdevelopmentrecords.com and support the podcast, the label, and my bearded little face. But the big support is going to be for The Cunts and their new single, Boris Johnson is still, or Boris Johnson's still a fucking cunt. And you'll hear all about that now as I talk to Cunt and the Gang on episode 425 of the Distraction Pieces podcast. This piece of fiction is the intro to Distraction Pieces. This piece of fiction is the intro to Distraction Pieces. This piece of fiction is the intro to Distraction Pieces. This piece of fiction is the intro to Distraction Pieces. Right, I'm joined today by Cunt of Cunt and the Gang of the Acceptable in the 80s podcast, author of I Cunt, and most recently frontman of The Cunts. Now, for anyone that's confused by any of that, I'll explain a lot of it in a bit. But to start things off, how are you, mate? Are you well?
Yeah, I'm all right, thanks. Yeah, just trundling along like everyone else.
Trundling along as ever.
Yeah.
I love it. I want to go all the way back to like early days and go for everything. A lot of people on the pod who listen to the podcast will know Stu Whiffin, who you grew up with. But I want to start with some more recent stuff, because around this time last year, you became a chart botherer.
I'm glad you mentioned that, because I didn't want to go through the whole narrative of Stu Whiffin being my more famous mate.
Get straight to the bit where you're the a superstar. So this time last year, you released Boris Johnson is a fucking cunt, largely because Boris Johnson is a fucking cunt.
Yeah.
And you got in the charts and everything, and you almost got Christmas number one. You came very close.
Yeah, I mean...
Tell me about it all.
It was a weird thing, because we remotely recorded the song, me and me punk band, The Cunts. So it's sort of four of us, you know, the standard lineup, me on vocals, Carso on guitar, and a bass player, and a drummer.
Yeah.
And we recorded the album just before lockdown. And then Boris Johnson is a fucking cunt was a song that kind of got tagged onto the album just after lockdown happened. But that was the one off the album that we recorded remotely. But it don't sort of sound any different to the others, really, because we're such basic elements just kind of mixed in with the others. And then had the album up on Spotify. And then, one day at the end of September last year, Ginger from the Wild Arts just tweeted a link to the song on Spotify with Christmas number one, question mark. And someone kind of flagged it up for me. I'm like, oh, fucking hell. I don't thought of that. You know, but it's one of them things that you just think, oh, you just thought nothing of it. And then Malta, who did the Rage Against the Machine campaign back in 2009.
Yeah,
I've sort of got to know him, being a fellow Essex lad. Yeah. And so I had a conversation with him, and he sort of, you know, sort of said, well, why not? And then by the end of October, Charlie Brooker had tweeted a link to it.
That's the one that I instantly screenshotted and sent to Whiffin. I was like, Charlie Brooker's on board now. This is big.
It was so fucking, but you know, it was just kind of, it was all sort of pie in the sky. But then the NME reported, because Charlie Brooker's such a big deal, the NME reported that he tweeted about it. Yeah. And then, and then things just started to snowball from there. And we got a little campaign together, because I'm a sort of veteran chart campaigner from, you know, sort of 10 or so years ago. I had a couple of goes at it with a couple of my Cunt and the Gang songs.
Yeah.
And we got to number 66 with Use My Arse, I Was a Cunt in 2010.
A classic.
And then, well, I just thought that the whole reason I did that was just, you know, just want to see what happens if a song called Use My Arse, I Was a Cunt gets into the top 40. What's Reggie Yates going to say?
Yeah, yeah. Because it's not like Killing in the Name Of, where they can say, we're going to fade out early.
Yeah.
Boris Johnson is a fucking cunt by the cunts. They can't introduce the song in any way, shape, or form. So
no.
So what happens?
That was the thing. Once it kind of got around, and it sort of snowballed from there. And then eventually in the week of the week of the charts, because I've got quite a small but sort of solid fan base. They all just went out and sort of bought it in that first couple of days, and it kind of got up into the Amazon charts and then started rising in the iTunes charts. And then all the press sort of had to report it. No one really obviously wanted to. Everyone wanted to ignore it and pretend it weren't happening, because the media is so kind of heavily biased to the right wing. And also, I think with the fucking bleakness of lockdowns, people were just looking for a feel-good story, you know, and you've got that bloke with his fucking sausage rolls doing the song for the food banks. And it was all... It was a nice narrative because it had been such a fucking miserable year. But I think in the same respect, that's what sort of worked in our favour, because people had such a fucking miserable time of it. And then the fucking dishevelled cancelled Christmas with 3 days to go, despite promising everyone that he weren't going to.
You must have been rubbing your hands together when he did that, right? Because it's like, you're playing into my narrative here. This is, surely we're going to get a bump.
The thing is you don't want to be that person that's rejoicing through everyone else's misery. But, you know, a part of me was going...
An arms dealer, where you go, oh, it's kicked off in Iraq again, but that is going to improve my bottom line.
It's good for the bottom line. Yeah. But, yeah, I mean, you couldn't have got someone to do a better PR job than him, just like right on fucking cue, you know. And that was the thing that just sent it, because it placed at 19 in the midweeks. Then he cancelled Christmas, and then finally it ended up at number 5. Mm. I mean, we was like, we were never going to beat the sausage roll song, because, you know, they fucking wheeled out Ronan Keating midweek. And
no, it's kind of beautiful, because those two things did tell the two stories of the lockdown. There's the goodwill, and there's the fucking hell, this government is a bunch of cunts. It is perfect for those two. But there's something I've always been impressed with from Simon Cowell, and it's the business side of the fact that with Britain's Got Talent and stuff like that, I think it's a bit of genius marketing, because everyone who loves it, certainly at its peak, everyone who loves it will be online when it's on tweeting about how much they love it, and everyone who hates it will be tweeting about how much they hate it. And I think that's a bit of genius. And I think that's the genius of Boris Johnson is a fucking cunt by the cunts, is as soon as it started to get in the charts and had to be seen, had to be noticed, had to be reported on, you've got the type of people who will see that and go, oh, I love a bit of this. I don't even care what it sounds like. I want to support this. And you'll get the people who are going, this should be banned. This shouldn't be allowed. And that'll just spread the reach more and more and more. So I don't want to over-intellectualise the wonder of it, but I think it is really clever. It's a really good way of doing things. It's like, right, well, let's get everyone talking about it, regardless of whether you're supporting or attacking.
That's completely true what you say. I mean, and I've sort of, you know, found this out through doing Cunt the Gang, is the haters are great for business.
Yeah.
Because they sort of reinvigorate everyone that supports it. You know, it's like, it becomes like that siege mentality.
Yeah.
You know, and this time around, you know, once the Mail started reporting on it and the Gammons got on the message boards, you know, and the weird juxtaposition of things was it was a lot of the Free Speech Brigade were trying to get it shut down.
Yeah.
And you can't have it both ways, you know, like it's a strange, you know, but yeah, that's just how it is. But, you know, like you say, it's great that people were talking about it and it was that just kind of got it out there, because the problem you have doing anything independently is you're up against the fucking Ed Sheerans and the Justin Biebers with, like, you know, the multi-million pound record companies backing them. And so the hardest thing is to make sure everyone finds out about it. That's the hardest thing. You know, you can have the best idea in the world, but if people don't hear about it, and, you know, it was still like, you know, in the weeks after, it charted, I still had people who were, you know, likers on my Facebook page saying, oh, mate, I can't believe I missed all this. And because, you know, it's the madness, social media companies squash your fucking reach down.
Yeah.
Like, it's you know, you just think, oh, fuck, that's a real shame. Lots of people missed out on the whole ride because, you know, I've been doing Cunt in the Gang for nearly 20 years, you know, and that was the single maddest week of my entire life, you know, and there's been some quite crazy things happening that time, but what a fucking mad week.
I do want to talk about all of it because, again, I've been witnessing Cunt and the Gang from the early days, and I do think there's some sometimes overlooked genius in it all, because on the surface there's obviously the crassness and the shock and the offensiveness, but I think you've done some of the best things marketing wise and some of the best videos and approaches, so we'll get into all of that. But how was it on that Christmas chart day when they're announcing what's going on and where it all lands? Because you will have been keeping an eye all the way along, but you have to keep an eye on Amazon charts, iTunes charts, all these different areas, right?
Yeah, I mean, like, the Amazon chart was the one that kind of kicked it all off, because you don't have to sell as many to kind of place high in the Amazon chart.
Yeah.
But at one point, I think we had, like, because I sort of done multiple versions of the song, you know, because they all get added together for the final chart.
Yeah.
I think we had, like, it was like 5 berths in the top 7 out of the Amazon chart. You know, brilliant. It's just really fucking satisfying to screenshot that, and it just said Boris Johnson is a fucking cunt 7 times on this little fucking screenshot. Yeah. You know.
Yeah.
You know, interspersed with Ronan Keating holding a pair of sausage rolls over the side of his head.
Yeah. It's a beautiful thing.
Yeah. And then, it sort of, you know, climbed up the iTunes chart. But it was like that final day when they kind of done the chart countdown, I was listening to it and just thinking, I feel like we've definitely got a top 20, but I don't know where it's going to be. I was sort of pretty convinced it weren't going to be Christmas number one, but I had a bit of insider info that it could have climbed, you know, up next to the number one.
Yeah,
but the Christmas streaming is so relentless of your Mariah Careys and your Last Christmases and stuff. I sort of looked back at the top 40 the other day, being a sad cunt I am that hasn't achieved anything else in that year. but I was looking back at that top 40, and it's almost exclusively Christmas songs.
Yeah,
you know, so it was quite an achievement. But on the day, I remember feeling a weird sort of sense of anticlimax, you know, but that only lasted, you know, for a couple of hours, and then you just go like, fucking hell, you know,
we got in
the fucking top 10, like, it's amazing.
It's mad. I think what was really good, because again, I was watching the campaign carefully, I was tweeting along and all, obviously, but what was good was you were keeping the pressure on, because one of the things I know from my music career is music that's not pop will often have a good first half of the week. And in the midweek charts, you'll look really strong because fans of music want to buy stuff on release.
Yeah.
Whereas the pop stuff it'll often get a bump towards the weekend because, as bizarre as it sounds, because it's all on sale in Tesco's and Asda and stuff like that. So people doing the weekly shop are picking it all up. So the fact that you kind of focused your fan base and got them streaming it on loop on Spotify or on Apple Music or whatever else, and really kind of went, look, let's sustain this push. It was beautifully done.
But I mean, that was sort of out of necessity more than anything, because, you know, like I said, because of who you're up against, you have to do all the fucking dirty tricks and cheats, you know, and
of course,
much against popular opinion, I don't feel like feel like I'm a person that enjoys promoting things. Do you know what I mean? Like, yeah. I went for nearly 10 years of, you know, after I did a big promotion thing at the Edinburgh Fringe in 2011, I went for nearly 10 years of not promoting anything, you know, outside my sort of emailing list and my social media, just because you sort of feel like you're whoring yourself out, and you can't do that all the time. That's why, like, these chart pushes, I couldn't do them all the time, because you haven't got the record company and that support infrastructure around you. You have to front it the whole time. Yeah. So I felt like fucking Bob Geldof, you know, on YouTube going, please buy the single, please buy the single, you know, but you have to do it, and it feels a little bit fucking soulless, and you have to kind of find creative ways to keep people interested and keep everyone fired up. But, you know, with the kind of negative comments that started coming in, that sort of looked after itself, you know, and people kind of doubled down. And because of the efforts of, you know, the sort of fan base that was supporting us in the first instance, that helped it kind of grow out beyond my normal reach. And once it kind of got out into the wider public, that's what kicked it on in the second half of the week.
How were the negative comments? Because Cunt and the Gang, it's always been about, again, that pushing it about as far as it will go, and you're going to get some backlash. But this was on a new level, right? Because of the exposure, because of being in the charts.
Yeah.
Did any of the negative stuff get to you or make you question anything? Or was it all good for business?
Do you know what? This time, there wasn't anything. I mean, like, people make personal comments about your appearance and stuff, and you just think, like, it's just a bit horrible, you know? And
yeah,
I think you can have the thickest skin in the world, but when people say horrible things about you, as a human being, it is fucking horrible.
Yeah.
But then, you know, if you put yourself out there, then he's part of it, and you have to just, you know, be tough about it and just go, well, fuck you, you know. Like, because the thing is for every negative comment, there's 100 people that like it, you know.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
But it's always like, you know, you look on fucking TripAdvisor, it's always the negative reviews that fucking stand out like a sore thumb, isn't it? And it's like, the people that hate something shout louder than the people that love a lot of the time.
Yeah, 100%.
And you know, that's something that's a bit fucking depressing, but I don't think it's going to change. I mean, like you sort of said, you know, in lockdown, I sort of felt, you know, when we first locked down, there was a real positivity and we're all in this together. And it lasted about a week. And then there's, like, you know, I saw some cunt with his boot full of toilet paper, and you're just like, no, we're all in it for ourselves again. Like, we're all stamping on each other's heads to get away from the zombies.
Yeah.
It's, you know, that fucking peace and love, it was a very short window of time, you know.
100%. And all the, you know, I'm probably just imagining it, but it felt like all the people that had spent the rest of the year saying, why are they crossing the channel and coming here? It can't be that bad. They need to get control of themselves. It's like, mate, you're filling your boot with toilet roll in case you can't have a shit. And again, I still maintain, and this plays to some of your back catalogue, but I still maintain the toilet roll shortage had nothing to do with toilets. It had to do with the fact that millions and millions of men were going to be at home every day now.
Yeah.
So it was purely masturbation based. that's the glaringly obvious answer that no one seemed to spot was there. So it went well last year, and kind of depressingly, Boris Johnson is still being a bit of a cunt. I mean, as we record this, we're recording this end of November. It'll be coming out a week of release of the new single. As we record this, he's just done a press conference, an important one, a COVID one, where he lost where he was, forgot what he was meant to be saying, and started talking about how we should all go to Peppa Pig Land because it's a really nice place with no trouble on the streets and things. Absolute nonsense. So
what the theme park?
Yeah.
He's going to turn out the theme park have donated some money to the Conservative Party.
That's what it's going to be. So Boris Johnson is still a fucking cunt. Is the next.
I mean, like,
iteration, right?
It feels a little bit fucking depressing that we have to go back and do it again. But you know, and don't get me wrong, I've thought long and hard about whether people are going to be interested enough to do it again. But do you know what? He's just no less of a cunt than last year. And I think, you know, there's been that, like, the lies and fucking sleaze and corruption and also just all the things that he's tried to turn a blind eye to, like, you know, to Cummings and Hancock and Patel, and they're bullying and fucking lying and double standards, mm-hmm. and Jenrick, you know, and his dodgy fucking business dealings. Like, all that's all happened on his watch. And every time he said, they've apologised to me and I think we need to move on.
Yeah.
And he had this fucking magic wand for a while where he could just kind of like wave his sleeve and everyone just moved on. And I'm like, but I don't want to move on. I want you to explain why that's happened on your watch, and I want that person fucking gone because it's corruption. And
yeah.
Like, that's why I'm back here this year, a year later, because this is the most overtly fucking corrupt government in my lifetime.
Yeah.
And he's the head of it. And, you know, and it rots from the top down, and he's so fucking rotten, you know. And also, he's a big fucking tree, and you don't fell it with one little swing of a chopper, do you? You have to keep chopping and chopping and chopping. So that's why I'm back. And I know, like, you know, I've sort of had some comments on Facebook, well, you're not still doing that. But I think the people that are actually saying that, they're obviously fucking voting for him, or they're embarrassed about voting for Brexit or whatever, because anyone that's still fucking supporting him and not complaining about him, when, you know, when they've tried to take away our fucking freedom to protest and, mm-hmm. and they've tried to change the rules for when they're caught being corrupt, like, the whole fucking thing is so rotten and stinks. Why wouldn't you try and get rid of him? You know, because no one could do a fucking worse job than he's done. You know, so when I was doing the... Sorry, I fucking... You sent me off on one.
No, good. Go ahead.
But you know, when I did the first one, I still had people commenting, you know, like, you know, as the song's fucking rising up the charts, well, it could have been worse. We could have had Jeremy Corbyn in charge. And, you know, you think, well, we've got the fucking worst per capita death rate in Europe, like the fourth worst in the world, you know, like, could it be any worse if Jeremy Corbyn was in charge?
That's the thing that gets me is... For every shit thing the Tories have done in the past, there's always an argument, well, it was a tough situation, you know, Labour probably wouldn't have done any better, no one could have done any better. And this is the one situation where they can't argue that, because it's a global thing. So we can look around the world and go, oh no, loads of countries did do better and can do better. So it's not a case of, yeah, but you know, no one... It could have done better. It is what it is. It's like, no, it isn't. it's not acceptable. As you say, our death rate has been through the roof. We've completely prioritised money over human lives. And it's been an absolute shambles. And as you touched upon earlier, the fucking laziest thing of each scandal being, well, they've apologised and it's time for us to move on. When I worked in HMV, I got to kind of management level, and I had this security guard, and he was a bit shit. And I pulled him up on something, and he came in and said, "Pip, I put my hands up. It's my fault. I'm sorry." And I was like, "All right, that's good." Then next time I pulled him up on something, he said, "Pip, I put my hands up. It's my fault. I'm sorry." And I was like, you can't just keep saying, like, he did it three or four times in a row. And then me and the manager had a chat. We're like, let's get him in. And he said, "Guys, I put my hands up. It's my fault." She's like, "Nah, you can't have that. You're suspended or you're some kind of disciplinary." Because it becomes a go-to. Again, I like someone apologising or admitting it or saying, you know, they've apologised, all these kind of things. But that can't be just a literal get-out-of-jail-free card. Some of the Hancock stuff is said to be prosecutable. Numerous things the government have done are said to be prosecutable. All the sleaze stuff and the changing of the laws to get them off the hook cunning, they're literally thinking it's a get-out-of-jail-free card, and it ain't. That doesn't exist.
No, but, I mean, like, you know, when the COVID deaths reached 100,000, you know, he said, "I accept full responsibility for it." And it's easy to say that, but how are you accepting full responsibility? Because... you know, you're putting off this inquiry until you're fucking gone. Like, that's not accepting full responsibility. What full responsibility is? He's calling for the inquiry into how it all fucking went wrong. You know, with the PPE and how COVID got into the care homes. Like, we need to be doing that now, because you know what use is it when they're all fucking gone? Yeah. Like, I want to see Nuremberg you know, yeah. with this bunch of cunts that have taken us through this and killed people. You know, I've got you know, a friend who lost his mum as part of, you know, part of the fucking pandemic. And, like, I just want to see fucking justice done for the people that have lost their loved ones. It's vile that they're all just fucking kicking a can down the road and putting it off. Yeah. Bollocks. Yeah. yeah.
Exactly. So, again, as you say, it is an interesting one because it's hard to know. I wonder what your views are on how this new version will do compared to the last version. Like, what are your hopes and expectations? Because it is tough. It is just, it's coming round again. But as you say, they've continued and he's been more of a cunt since then.
Yeah.
in general.
In terms of expectations, I just haven't got a fucking clue.
Yeah.
But, you know, I sort of didn't have any expectations last time. You know, it started to feel good and it started to feel, you know, like something was happening. But at the very start of the week, I remember that first day, I thought, oh, do you know, I wish I hadn't bothered. You know, like, because you sort of put, it was such a lot of work into kind of getting everything together. Like, I fucking hate admin. But when, you know, I'm sure as you know, when you run your own thing, yeah. like it's 80% admin for being able to get to do that, you know, 10% fucking creative stuff. I don't know what you do the other 10% of the time, but it ain't 20%. Like, I'd like to be sat here at my computer writing songs every day, but...
Mate, it's why I've stopped releasing things on my label, because it was just admin after admin, and I'd always get hit by something I'd forgotten. And because I was always just running the label myself... If I'm either feeling I've let down an artist because I've missed something and it's going to be a bit late or this or that, or I'm just getting a bill from MCPS or whoever else it is because I've pressed some vinyl and they want some money for it. And it's like, fucking, yeah.
Yeah.
It's a lot of the boring stuff. But
it's a lot of sorting out, you know, because on the surface things, I know a lot of people think I look like a graceful swan, but, you know... Under the river, though, you know,
most of the comments about your appearance was they saying, I mean, this song's shit, but at least he is a graceful swan, to be fair. Well, I want to kind of rewind all the way back and get into everything, because genuinely, in my kind of late teens, early 20s, there wasn't a bigger local band than Cunt and the Gang. And obviously you didn't remain a local act, but I remember so much excitement from all my friends. But to go even further back, were you part of Serious Problem? Because I was really young when I was going to see Serious Problem, and that's the band that Stu Whiffen was in. Were you part of that originally and then started doing other stuff? Like, what was the deal there?
Me and Stu started it off.
Yeah.
And I was in it for the first four gigs, but... It was shit when I was in it. Like, it was really shit. It was just like me and Stu had written all these songs when we were sort of, you know, like 14 or 15. And I suppose we must have been like 18 or 19 and decided to get a band together and play these old songs, you know. And they were like really crummy. They weren't very funny. And the band we got together, like, it was just a load of young kids, because we couldn't, you know, we couldn't get anyone our own age in it because it was such a dire idea. It was just all these young kids who just picked up their instruments and were sort of in their first band. And so, you know, everything was out of time. But it was an inspiring, glorious racket.
Yeah.
But, you know, it weren't going anywhere when I was in it. And because there were 14 of us, and you imagine trying
too
to fucking...
Many.
Mate, trying to organise rehearsals with four people is a fucking nightmare. Like, but to get 14 people in one place at any time. And there was about five people who didn't really do anything, but just wanted a microphone. But there weren't enough microphones to go around. So if me or Stu left our microphone alone for a minute, you know, there'd be a crowd of people who'll dive for it.
Stu would always describe it as kind of the Beastie Boys, but more offensive. But it was the Bloodhound Gang before the Bloodhound Gang, essentially. It was. It was meant to be shocking and offensive lyrics. Yeah. It was.
No, after I went along to see them, like, a few gigs later, and, like, suddenly they were really fucking good. And, you know, you think, oh, fuck, has that happened? But,
seven
like,
people,
you know,
had left. And you were left with a really big band still. It's perfect.
It must have been the others that left. Yeah. Dragging it down. But yeah. But yeah, they were really good, and like the chemistry was right as well because you had Stu holding everything together at the front, and Jill just had a free rein to piss about and just be a silly cunt. And like he was quite mesmerising on stage, so I don't want to blow smoke up his ass too much. So I know he listens to this, but they were a great fucking band, and they had DJ Destruction on the decks, and so yeah. They had so many different facets. It was like fucking a rock rap crossover, and like a big fucking sound with scratching and wild wild guitars, and just these really fucking offensive lyrics over the top. And if anyone in the crowd dissented, they'd just shout them down.
Yeah.
You know, and just like be really offensive about them and their mums and anything, you know. So anyone that kind of dissented just got shouted down.
Yeah.
And it was quite a false, you know, and they got a big following, you know, and won a local battle of the bands and stuff. And they'd always take like two buses of people wherever they went.
Yeah.
But it was, you know, the difference between what they was doing and when I kind of started up on my own was that would have been like early 90s, so there was no internet, and you know what you had to do was you'd take your following in buses into London and hope that a record company person was there, that, you know, there was no MySpace or sending MP3 demos or anything.
Yeah.
And they had a bit of record company interest with was it Gut who did like the Right Said Fred records and
right,
Space
yeah,
and
yeah,
stuff.
That's right, yeah.
And but then, you know, just like always happens, nothing really happened with it, and then people just fucking lost interest and went into other bands, and then it all just fizzled out. But it, for a couple of years, it was glorious, you know.
It really was. And did that kind of inspire you in the long term into what you did when you started to perform as Cunt and the Gang? Like, how was that as a starting point?
I think ultimately, I've always done the same thing, you know, since like writing them early songs with Stu.
Yeah.
They've just always been silly, you know, just silly fucking things that I like to write about, like little minutiae of life, and also the kind of things you might say to your mates down the pub that you wouldn't kind of mention in polite conversation. And that's what Cunt and the Gang kind of sprung from, you know, like your gentleman's washes and those kind of little asides that you have in a pub that you wouldn't mention in front of your nan.
Mate, they became part of the local vernacular. All the gentleman's wash stuff, as you mentioned earlier, use my arsehole as a cunt, were all just, because they're incredibly offensive, which young boys in particular will enjoy. But they were really well written pop songs. They were just catchy as anything, so it would stick in your head so clearly.
That's what I've always liked doing, is just writing catchy pop songs. And I think because of the nature of it, you know, where it was just kind of me with Casio-style backing,
yeah,
you could get away with using them cheesy advert melodies, you know, that if you were in a proper band, you wouldn't touch them with a shitty stick because they're just too, you know, too saccharine. But, you know, like those like, you know, those sort of major chord melodies coupled with the offensive lyrics just repeated over and over. They get stuck in your head. And that was the thing that was pleasing for me. Like, within a couple of years of starting off, I had people saying to me, oh God, I was at a family funeral the other day and used my arsehole as a cunt just wouldn't go from my head. And I was sort of just sat there, you know, with my head in my hands while they buried granddad.
And mate, is that a euphemism? it didn't stay local, though. You toured and... You mentioned the Fringe earlier, and that run at the Fringe where you made a load of stickers that said cunt on them, and it became the news story of the Fringe that year because everyone who came to your gigs was putting them on everyone else's Fringe posters. And
the stickers didn't. The stickers were just. I might even have one here too.
Oh, there you go. Yeah.
Oh, it didn't even say cunt. It was a dick, wasn't it? Yeah.
That was it. It was just a crudely drawn cock.
Yeah, that's right.
And so people just stuck them over everyone else's posters.
Yeah, and the amount of comedians who poster is them stood there with their mouth open in some shape or form. That was it. It was just, yeah, basic dick stickers that were then covering the whole of the Fringe.
I was sort of encouraging people to take a sticker. I said, take a sticker and go and stick it on a poster, you know, somewhere you feel it's appropriate. And what I didn't realise was that people were just taking big handfuls of them. I sort of presumed like 150 people in a night, they'll all take one, stick them around. But people were just taking big handfuls. So within 2 or 3 days, they were just fucking everywhere. And I didn't properly think it through because I didn't think along the lines of, oh, people have paid hundreds of pounds in advertising for them poster sites. I just thought it'd be really funny to see someone with their mouth open and a cock in it. Yeah. And people got really angry. Like
comedians?
Like some comedians, yeah, like had a real sense of humour bypass. But it was mostly like the big companies that put the shows on whose posters got defaced.
Yeah, of course.
And yeah, they were really cheesed off about it. And I think it was when, because the Fringe runs for like 3.5 weeks or something, but after a week, Alex, who run the free festival, just called me up and said, listen, mate, you're going to have to stop giving out the cocks, because he'd had the people from Fringe Central just like, you know, saying that they'd had so many fucking phone calls about it, people giving them grief.
Yeah.
And then like one of the big promoters had threatened to sue him and sue me. And
Mate, put the cocks away. It's not worth it.
Back in your trousers. My favourite thing was these two guys from the Edinburgh Council Environmental Department turned up at my show one night before I went on and made me sign this bit of paper to say I wasn't going to stick any more stickers in. I said, oh, it wasn't me sticking them anywhere.
I've not done any of them. Yeah.
And they've pulled out these photocopies of just where they'd found all these cocks. And one of them said, mate, I've spent the last 24 hours pulling off over 200 cocks. Good work if you can get it.
We'll get back to work. it's funny because we inadvertently, me and Dan Lesac inadvertently, I think in some way subconsciously influenced by that, had a similar thing at the Camden Crawl, because Camden Crawl was our first big thing we did after Thou Shalt Always Kill came out, and our label had made a load of stickers that said just a band on them. And obviously that part in that song is listing band names and saying just a band.
Yeah.
We gave them all out at gigs, and Camden Crawl's a similar one. There'll be band posters everywhere, so every band name was covered over by a just a band.
Fantastic.
By the end of that night. And it helped us massively. It again, exactly the same way, it got people talking about it. People who weren't at the... More people knew about it than could have got into our two gigs at Camden Crawl. So it did more, has more of an impact. But was it at the Fringe that Stuart Lee heard about you and became, you know, a supporter? He stuck up for you, right?
I think it was that year, like the furore around the cocks drove him along to see us.
Yeah.
And he came to see us at that venue and he came to see us one night. And I spotted him in the audience. Oh, fucking hell, Stuart Lee's in the audience. And, you know, obviously he's God, isn't he,
yeah,
basically?
100%.
And then he came back the next night with his missus just to check it was all right to like it, I presume. but come up afterwards and just, like, had a few words and was just really, really fucking nice and humble and, you know, just generally enthusiastic about it. And then he'd kind of come back and, you know, see us other years at the Fringe, you know, and I sort of bumped into him a couple of times walking around and had a good chat with him. And he's a really fucking good egg.
Yeah, he
But
really
then I'll
is.
Say that about anyone that likes my stuff, you know. If Fred West was into it, I'd be like, see, that man's work is fantastic.
He's all right. He's all right deep down. Well, speaking of Stuart Lee bringing his missus along to see if it was all right to like, I want to talk to you about how the kinds of songs that you write age as you age. And the reason I'm bringing this up is I was playing, me and my partner were going up north a year or so ago. It was just after Acceptable in the 80s had started. And I popped an episode on and I'm a big fan of the podcast. I think it's great. I want to talk about that a bit as well. But I was like, oh, are you familiar with a Cunt and a Gang? And she's like, no, not really. So I was like, oh, go on YouTube and we'll get some songs up. And these are, you know, a lot of them, at that point, you'd stopped for a while. So a lot of them I haven't heard in a long old time. And it was 50-50 on the ones I was like, yeah, this is what I'm talking about. And the ones I was going, oh, I don't remember it being that way, that offensive or that horrible. It was a real mixture of my missus going, well, this is funny and going, why are you making us listen to this? So,
yeah.
And Whiffen has spoken numerous times about how there's certain serious problem songs that he never wants to to see, be reminded of. Yeah, to see the light of day, to be reminded of. So, yeah, I guess, how do you feel about all of that? Because the point of them is, at points, to part of the humour is the shock. So I'm not saying the point of them is the shock, but part of the humour is the shock and the, oh, we shouldn't be saying this in front of people. So, yeah, how's that felt as you've got older and wiser?
Well, do you know what? I always, like, right from the very start, I sort of made a conscious decision to just be flippantly offensive with it.
Yeah.
And to try and ride it out by presenting it like a kids' TV presenter, you know, because when you go and see Serious Problem, there was a lot of that sort of finger pointing. But I made a conscious decision to not do it in a finger pointy way, to do it in a jazz hands kind of way.
Yeah, I feel you. Yeah.
And you got away with a lot more doing it like that because it was less sort of threatening. But over lockdown, I was sort of doing a lockdown sort of online show that called Corona Club, and I kind of went through and played pretty much my entire back catalogue throughout that. And you're right, there's some that have aged better than others, and I think some of that is to do with the world has changed, changed a lot, and obviously, you know, I've grown as a person as well, but the idea behind Cantner Gang was to sort of be an eternal 15-year-old boy.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
And yeah, 100%.
Like, even when I was in my 30s, you know, I'm hugely fucking immature, and that's why, like, I never sort of lasted long in the world of work, because I'm just a, you know, a silly bastard that wants to muck around a lot. But I like that kind of, that sort of naive innocence of, what, I've just said that? Oh, you know, I hold my hands up, I'm sorry, you know, like you said, hold my hands up, I'm sorry, and then let's all just move on. I'm basically fucking Boris Johnson set to a Casio backing track.
100%. But it's the beauty of it. I was watching, and you were saying you don't want to blow smoke up Mr. Gell's ass, but I'm going to blow some smoke up yours now. I was watching the documentary recently, the Frank Sidebottom a documentary, and I could see so many parallels to what you do as Cunt. Obviously, it's a far more offensive version, but it's finding a character and kind of making an art of being this weird character on stage. Yours happens to be incredibly offensive, and part of the art is making us all feel comfortable to be in a room saying these things or singing along to these things that we shouldn't be singing along to and saying. So how's that been? And have you ever found, have you ever been writing something, for example, that you've gone, no, maybe not. Maybe that's too far.
Yeah, of course, yeah.
Yeah.
But then...
And still, how many of your friends did you tell that version? But it never, like, made it onto the stage.
There's only three or four people that I tell the ones that don't make it out. And I always, like, pat them down first to make sure there's no recording devices on. But, I mean, the thing is once... It's like anything. This is my reality, and I've become completely fucking desensitized to what's all right and what's not. But you still kind of you know, and you make a moral judgment on things, and it doesn't stop you having ideas that are that side of the line.
And
I'll record them into my phone because it's an idea, so it's valid. But that doesn't mean that I want to tell everyone about it, because some things you're just like, do you know what? It's just not worth the fucking grief. And this is something that happens as you kind of get older. But still, like, a few of those ideas that were just the other side of the line for me, I still ended up recording and putting on that final album, because I didn't think I'd ever be doing it again. But you know, I listening back to that and listening back to, you know, the back catalogue as a whole, there are some songs on there that I wouldn't play anymore, just because the world's changed. Or, you know, for example, like, I've got a song called Young Girl off of my second album, which was, like, you know, 2006. And it was meant to be a play on that old song, Young Girl, you know, Young Girl, Get Out of My Mind, My Love For You Is Way Out of Line, which when you look at the lyrics, fucking hell, it's Operation U-Tree. How they haven't been around Gary Puckett's house and picked him up.
Yeah.
But it's sort of the era. And my idea for this song, Young Girl, was, you know, I'm trying to do the right thing, but I've ended up back around her house and I've only just found out she's, you know, she's not 16 till next month. So I'm trying to do the right thing, but just putting the situation in people's mind of like, oh, but what would happen if I do that? But I wouldn't do it. But what would happen if I did that? But I wouldn't do it. But it was all right when I was in my late 20s and early 30s to sing that song. Well, no, it weren't really, but now it'd be like, you know, like it, when you look at the Carry On films now, we're like Sid James, like, ooh, yeah, over them sort of teenage girls. Yeah. Like, that's, it was all right in the 70s.
But even with stuff like that, man, it's written as a clearly inappropriate joke. Yet you do look at, like, there was an amazing documentary recently that looked at some of the stuff Iggy Pop wrote about and did Steven Tyler from Aerosmith literally getting legal custody of a 15-year-old he was involved with so that he could take her over borders on tour and stuff like that. And all like having this in their autobiographies, in their songs. So I'm far more comfortable with someone writing something like that kind of to say, look how mental all this is, than the people who have done that, who are now just beloved and accepted as heroes and icons. And it's like, all right, how's that work? But, I mean, speaking of beloved people, we're running out of time already, but we've still got a decent amount. Can you share your story of the warm water that your Amy Winehouse song got you in?
So I did a tribute to Amy Winehouse because I sort of, somewhere along the line, I became a hearse chasing synth pop tribute act. I think it was made like the Michael Jackson death, you know, because his life sort of ended in the last few years in such bizarre circumstances. And then obviously, like, Amy Winehouse died quite shortly and tragically. So, you know, I liked Amy Winehouse's music and I thought it might be a bit of a laugh to do a tribute that actually was meant to be fond, but just making light of it a little bit. And I clearly misjudged the mark somewhere along the line. And we turned it around fairly quickly and got it up. And like all the kind of topical things, it flew on YouTube, you know, and the hits kind of went up quite quickly. But I was doing a gig about 6 months later down in this little bar opposite Highbury Tube Station. And I just sort of sat there having a beer before the gig. And this bloke's sort of come up with sort of beanie hat on and tracksuit, this little guy, and just held this newspaper up that said "Insult to my Amy" on the front of it. And, you know, I just went to him, very funny, mate. And he's just reached inside his tracksuit and he's pulled out a water pistol and pointed it at me. And so I'm like, yeah, very funny, mate, nice one. And then he's just started squirting it and it's gone on me. And so I've just jumped up and sort of put my finger on the end of it. And he sort of like jumped back and just started squirting at me going, "It's my piss, it's my piss, it's my acrid piss." And so my once I've heard that, I've just gone crack and knocked him over and sort of laid the boot in. And he's kind of got himself up and sort of scrambled himself out of the venue and just run past the doorman. So I've run up the stairs after him and like said to the doorman, "What the fuck? Did you see where that bloke went?" He went, "No, he just like ran past me, mate." And I went, he said, "I wonder what's going on, because he just sort of snuck in a minute ago." You know, you think, yeah, cheers for that.
Did a good job, lads.
"What's going on there?" I said, "I've just been assassinated with piss." But I sort of had the red mist at this point, and I've gone back down the stairs. I was fucking furious. And some bloke come up and went, "You all right, cunt?" I went, "No, not really, mate. I've just been assassinated with piss." He said, "Oh, I wonder what was going on. I just heard you go, 'He's a mentalist,' and then deck him." But I had no memory of... I just obviously fucking got the red piss. I had no memory of saying that.
You went full Partridge in your moment of madness. I love it. Well, I mean, a lot of this stuff came up in your book, I Can't. And you touched earlier upon your fan base. And it's one of the things I loved about this was you decided to do a kind of a memoir and kind of tell the story. It was at the point, as you said, that you were like, "I'm not going to be doing any of these songs anymore. I want to kind of..." Because there's a lot of mad moments along the way,
there's a lot of mad moments. I think that kind of comes from the fact where I never had, you know, I was never like looked after, you know, management wise or anything. So I'd turn up to the gigs and you basically spent the whole night socialising with a crowd rather than locked away in a dressing room. So, you know, you got the full fucking brunt of it.
Yeah.
That every tour. And I think ultimately, like, that's part of the thing that burnt me out with gigging was, you know, it's quite hard to be switched on for that amount of time for like 100 odd nights a year. You know, it just fucking, you know, like, I always feel like a bit of a wimp saying this because it's not hard like a proper job, you know, like a proper physical job, like filling up Calagas bottles and fucking loading lorries and stuff. But mentally, it frazzles you. Like,
I completely understand, mate. Yeah.
Doing like 6 hours of banter a night for sort of 50 nights in a row, it really does fucking, it frazzles you. But I don't think I really realised that while I was doing it. It was only when I kind of come to the end of it, it just wore me out.
When I was touring a lot, my missus at the time would get really annoyed that I wasn't up for going and hanging about at festivals. I was up for doing the festival and then leaving because of exactly that. Because it's like, right, I'm not actually getting to relax at the festival because I've played there. There's going to be a certain amount of people. I'm 6'4" with a big beard, so I stand out anyway. There's going to be a certain amount of people who want me to be Scroobius Pip for them in that moment. So if we're spending a weekend at a festival, it's a weekend kind of exhaustion because, as you say, and it is a weird one because I've worked in factories, I've worked in shops, I've worked in restaurants, all these kind of things, but it is mentally exhausting. And I think it's a weird one because if you're working class in those situations, you feel guilty for being exhausted by it, if you know what I mean. Because you are like, well, it's not a proper job, but I'm having a breakdown. I remember on our US tour, I wrote out a full letter of resignation and the guilt I felt because all my mates who were still working in HMV, I'm sitting there thinking, I'm living all of our dreams and I'm miserable because I'm exhausted and I can't handle it and I'm going to quit. And it's a weird one, man. It's a weird psychological pressure.
Yeah, but I mean, it's exactly that what you said. It's where, like, you know, where you come from a working class background and you know how hard, like, you know, how hard my dad had to work for his money. The idea that, like, you know, I could turn down a gig that was offering 300 quid.
Yeah.
And that in the end burnt me out is the fact that, like, every time I tried to shorten the tours down and lose the couple of worst paying or, you know, or gigs where someone has had assaulted me on stage and I hadn't been properly fucking looked after.
Yeah.
You know, you'd sort the tour out, you'd announce the tour and then, like, someone would go, oh, come back to Swindon, everyone really misses you. And then you just end up fucking taking the gig because you feel, you know, because, like, there was lots of nice people come along to them gigs and you're just like, oh, I do feel mean leaving it out. And so, but in the end, it burns you out.
I remember the year I did the Fringe, I could only be there for 19 days of the run. So I did a show every night. And the person who was booking it said, like, you should have a night, like a day off every week. And I was like, you fucking kidding me? Every day is a day off. I'm doing an hour's work each night, mate. This ain't a proper job. Absolutely burnt me out. Because again, it's not. You're getting in that zone. You're doing the beforehand stuff and the after stuff. And it is exhausting. But what I wanted to say about I Cunt was, you and me chatted a little bit about it as you had the idea and whether you should go to a publisher. And it's a weird thing. With the gigs, being called cunt in the gang, it really means you're not going to get too many people who are there not expecting what they get, if you know what I mean. Because it's a name that people are going to go, all right, it's going to put the wrong people off easily and hopefully draw the right people in.
Do you know what? But that's what I thought. And then when you go to the Edinburgh Fringe, it completely turns it.
Because everyone's an artist.
I mean, at the Edinburgh Fringe, I saw people having the most miserable night of their entire fucking life in my show.
Yeah.
And sometimes I gave them a get out, and other times I just let it go, you know, or other times I kind of confronted it. But then first couple of years, especially when you do the, because I was doing three shows. Most of the time I was there, so you do the show, and then you do a bucket collection at the end.
Yeah, yeah.
So there weren't that investment of someone having to pay like 15 quid for a ticket or whatever.
Yeah,
and you'd end up with you know, like, with some randoms in, or someone that had dragged a mate along who just weren't into it.
Weren't right.
And you'd see people just sat there like with their arms crossed, and their arms would get higher and higher and higher as the show went on. And so like it becomes quite demoralising in the end seeing someone having such a fucking terrible time. So I'd either rat them out or like, I started doing a warning at the start of the show saying like, you got a free song amnesty. And if I still see you having a miserable fucking time after that, I'm going to single you out.
It's perfect.
And so like after the first song, you'd see a couple of people get out and walk and people would go, eh! And I'd go, no, leave them alone. It's the amnesty. It's fine. Like, you know, it'd be better without them.
Well, the kind of the opposite of the demoralising element, as I said, we were talking about whether it's best to try and get a publisher involved, which can be tough when you've got the name cunt, or if you go your own route. And I was kind of cautioning you on going the crowdfunding route because, again, crowdfunding blew up a good 10 years before that, but everyone then thought crowdfunding was always going to be, I'll put it out there, everyone will want it. A failed crowdfunding project is one of the most demoralising things in the world because that's essentially saying, I'm not for the big business, but the people want me. And then the people turn around and go, no, we don't want you either. Coming. But you did yours and it was a fucking roaring success and you met your target in no time and exceeded it. Like, how was that? And was it expected?
No. I mean, completely unexpected because I'd quit gigging 2 years before.
Yeah.
And, you know, I sort of, that final tour, I weren't going to announce it as a final tour. I was just going to kind of bow out at the end of it and say, thanks very much, everyone. And with him being Mr. Business, went to me, are you fucking joking? Say it's a final tour, you'll sell loads of tickets. So, of course, I'm like, oh, God, right, fuck it. So,
I did that with mine. I told everyone it was the final tour and no one believed us. It went well, but then literally in the last 8 years since that final tour, constantly people were going, well, I didn't know it was your final tour. Like, it wasn't just a marketing thing. Whiffing was not involved. This was legit.
So, yeah, a couple of years after that, the dwindling pot of cash had fucking dwindled and I was back painting and decorating and tiling for me mate on a casual basis. And I'd sort of written the book in that time, you know, while the cash dwindled, I sort of, you know, went hard into writing the book and got it near enough finished. But I sort of didn't have a pot to piss in and wouldn't have been able to get any print copies done. And I went and had a meeting with a publisher and it just didn't really light their fire.
Yeah.
And I can kind of see why, because it's an odd thing to market. You know, if you're trying to advertise or promote something, especially like in the era where podcast is king, you know, if you had to bleep out every cunt tonight, there wouldn't be a lot left, would there?
Yeah, exactly.
Like I say, went down the crowdfunding route, just not knowing what to expect. But I did a bit of a cheaty kind of heart wrenching video of me in my fucking painty gear when I just got home from work, just saying, look, if you want the book, back the crowdfunder. And people like reached the target in the first 24 hours. It just went crazy. Like, but I think that's because I'd been away for a couple of years and like absence makes the art grow fonder. And like, I'm still really happy with the book, you know, and there's a lot of doing the book was more about all them stories, just not getting lost, you know, lost into the ether, because I'm the only one that remembers them all.
Yeah,
you know, like other people will remember different ones, but you know, like a lot of them, they stop with me. So when I croak, all them stories disappear, but at least now they're written down, because some of it would just be a real fucking shame if they just disappeared and, you know, were never heard again.
The thing that's sold me on the book was Carol Whiffin saying how fucking hilarious it was, because I ain't going to believe Stu's in it, he'll love it, he'll be all over it, because it's like, oh, here's me in my heyday doing my things. But Carol was like just cracking up and the funniest thing she's ever read. So I was like, all right, this sounds good then.
That was weird for me as well, having Stuart's missus enthusiastic about me for a couple of weeks. It was fantastic. It was like living in a Twilight, you know, parallel universe.
I love it. Well, to wrap things up, I want to talk a bit about Acceptable in the 80s, because Stu, as anyone who listens to, Tedis will know, comes up with a lot of podcast ideas. He does a lot of podcasts, and he'll often bounce the idea off me. And I'll, you know, it could be good, it could be bad. But when he came to me with this one, I just thought it was gold. So basically, you two realised that you'd known each other for 40 years.
Yeah.
So you decided to meet up once a month and go back 40 years and look at your memories from then, but also films, music and TV that was on then. And it's kind of never ending because you're always going to be...
Every month you can always go back 40 years.
Yeah. And it's perfect. I really enjoy it. It's perfect for anyone around your age, around my age, because there is the nostalgia hit. I think people think that Stu's uselessness and forgetfulness is a running joke. I know it's not. I know that he genuinely doesn't know if you start with films every time or not. But yeah, how's it been doing that? Because as you said, there's probably been a reluctance, or I guess, how's it been finding the right thing to do in the podcast kind of realm and just enjoy it with your mate?
Well, do you know what? Like Stu sort of said a few times about doing. Yeah, I mean, Stu was one of the first people that probably the first person I heard use the word podcast, because he was talking about it when Ricky Gervais was doing it and saying we should bring a mic down the pub and just like record us all having a beer.
Yeah,
and it took me kind of 20 years to get on board. It was just because we were meeting up for a beer, you know, every couple of weeks or every month, and I realised that our friendship was the last thing in Stu's life that he hasn't monetized. So, it just seemed like, you know, that 40th anniversary just seemed like quite a natural thing to do. And we just went into the first one with, well, we'll just record us having a beer and talking about things that happened 40 years ago and like spin-off stories and stuff. And if it don't work, then that's that. But like we both had, you know, it was just like, it was sort of just like having a beer. It took us a couple of months to get into the rhythm of it.
Yeah.
But now it is just like meeting up for a beer.
Mate, there was an amazing episode where I swear neither of you remembered any of the films or any of the TV show or any music. So it was an hour of listing films and songs. No, I've got no memories on that. But yeah, I mean, I also thoroughly enjoy... It's Stu that gets confused with it, but his confusion over whether it's best to take the charts from the beginning of the month, the middle or the end, and it makes no difference if you stick to the same one each time.
Yeah.
It's when you're taking from the end one month and then the beginning next month, and Stu's like, oh, we've had these, haven't we? It's like, yeah, of course you have.
I wasn't sure if he was doing that for effect, but it's too fucking consistent to be put on.
The other thing that you know, he'll on all of his podcasts, he'll regularly at some point bring up how hairy I am, and I'm quite hairy. Like you can look at my big hairy hands. But Stu is someone who gets his daughters to shave his back for him on a regular basis. So why is he digging people out for being hairy? I don't know anyone hairier than Stu. It's outrageous.
No, but it's because you're not there to defend your hairiness, are you? You're not there to compare the hair, so exactly. It's just point scoring in your absence.
He is, but so...
They are very hairy hands,
they are
though,
hairy hands, aren't they? I thought I'd show you on...
do you know what? I've just read... Stu lent me the book about the making of American Werewolf in London.
Yep.
So that, I would say that would be, you know, well, like the sort of the second or third model that would be. Yeah,
definitely would be. So, I mean, how's it been making the podcast? Because it is, as you say, in a way, it's adding structure to something that you were just doing socially. But I think at times that can be a good thing because you are doing a bit of research and you are turning up and going, rather than turning up and talking about what you've all been up to the last month or so, or Stu putting on some miserable fucking records, you actually, you're getting to have a go and chat over films and TV and everything.
He still fritzalizes me with YouTube for 3 hours after the podcast finished, so don't worry about that.
Of course he does.
But it's really like, it's not actually changed anything because we were sort of meeting up for a beer, like usually around his bar anyway. So he's sort of just carried on how it is, except for now there's like half a dozen people on Twitter bother me if we haven't had a beer before like the 8th of the month.
Yeah. Yeah, it is incredibly inconsistent on when the release date is. It's like, I'll turn up.
It's all to do, it's because he's recording 14 podcasts every week. It's all to do with when he can squeeze us in.
When he can squeeze in another podcast. If he isn't recording a podcast, he's on fucking holiday in horrible parts of England.
I'm surprised he hasn't taken a Bluetooth headset and just records them while he's walking around with his wife and kids in St. Joseph.
It is likely. Well, I'll wrap things up as we're nicely over the hour mark there. Boris Johnson is still a fucking cunt, will be available everywhere, right? Is it 17th of December you're dropping it? That's the day that this podcast will be coming out, so I'll be putting it out to celebrate the launch and...
Oh, brilliant. Thank you.
Push people into that 1 week to buy and listen as much as they can.
Yeah, and I have to say, like, today I just got tweeted a sickening picture of Ed Sheeran and Elton John, like, in Christmas jumpers with a Christmas tree in the background. And you're just like, you know, I will just say to your listeners, if you want that as Christmas number one, then fucking good for you. But in fact, there is an alternative. Just do the alternative, please.
There certainly is. And I've pushed Ed's appearance on the podcast to after Christmas. So I'm giving you the unfair advantage here of the massive platform of the Distraction Pieces podcast.
Thanks, Pip. Keeping it Essex and real.
It'll make all the difference. And where can people find you online? I should have mentioned this every time that we've been saying cunt. I mentioned it in the intro. It's cunt with a K.
Yeah.
So we've not been saying anything offensive all of this time, really. I like that we've left that until the end as a big reveal.
Those of you that are still there, it wasn't offensive.
It's like the sixth sense. Turns out it was with a K all along. But yeah, where can people find you on socials?
You can find me, my website's at katg.co.uk, and I'm on Twitter and Facebook as Cunt and the Gang. But I urge you, above all this week, please go to www.borisjohnson.info and a plot spoiler, the info is he's still a fucking cunt.
Yes, I love it. Well, thank you very much for coming and chatting, mate. It's been a pleasure.
Thanks, Pip. I really appreciate it, mate. Cheers.
You've been listening to Scroobius Pip's Distraction Pieces.
There we go. That was episode 425, and that was cunt. And I love the reveal there that you all thought we'd been swearing the whole podcast, but we were saying cunt with a K. So it is truly the sixth sense of the podcast world. M. Knight, I can't think of a way to make that into my name, even though he's got a silly surname and I've got a silly first name. I hope you enjoyed that. I hope you weren't too offended. I hope you go and buy Boris Johnson's Still a Fucking Cunt on Apple or Amazon and then stream it for days on Spotify and get behind the calls. I'll be back next week. Oh, is it Drunkcast time? I think it might be Drunkcast time, guys. I'll be back next week with the end of year Drunkcast, which I'm sure you can agree is very exciting. Until then, stay safe. Stay and enjoy all of it. I highly recommend, I know we talked about it, but Acceptable in the 80s, go and listen to that podcast. It's good fun. Yeah, I'll see you next week. Until then, stay safe and stay sane. Ta-ta.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.